Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
Hi folks, welcome to episode 93 of the Epochs of the Lotus Eaters. I'm joined by Bo, and today we're going to be talking about, what was it, Ernest Shackleford?
Sir Ernest Shackleton.
Shackleton, yeah. Sorry. So I know the name because we mentioned him last time, and I have heard the name before because he's an explorer, but I don't really know anything about him.
Okay. Well, they made a TV show about it, like a two-part special thing with, or three-part special thing, with Kenneth Branagh a few years ago. And that's very good, I think. But this story is, I can never make up my mind which story I like more, the Scott story or the Shackleton story.
Well,
but they're very, very different.
I like tragedies, so right. I like the Scott story.
Well, he well, goes,
I mean, who knows about this?
Shackleton goes down to the South Pole in a ship called the Endurance.
Yeah.
And that's ironic because, perhaps irony isn't the right word, but they go through the most incredible test of endurance that humans can go through.
Maybe it's appropriate.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very appropriate. Yeah. Yeah.
I do love, just a quick side note, the naming conventions of the British Empire. Like, it's not the HMS Philadelphia. No. It's the HMS Victory or Indomitable or Endurance or, you know, and it's it's these virtues as names, which I think is fascinating. You know, it's very heroic.
Yeah. It's great stuff. Well, we talked about the Scott story where there were people that these were like hardier men than now. Well, it's dialed up even more for Shackleton.
Right.
So where Amundsen had got the South Pole, it was still a largely unexplored landmass almost entirely.
Yeah.
So the Admiralty and Ernest Shackleton himself decided that what they're going to do is walk across the entire Antarctic.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Walk across it from one side to the other.
What, across the South Pole?
Yeah. Oh,
good idea.
From one side to the other.
Yeah, why not? How could that go wrong?
Yeah. So they is biting off a big challenge.
Isn't it about the same size as Australia?
Yeah, it's gigantic, yeah.
Yeah, it's massive.
Yeah, yeah. It's a continental landmass size thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, okay. And it's all just, you know, covered in ice.
With mountains and that high plateau.
Yeah.
That's one of the most inhospitable places in the world.
Yeah,
in fact, it is the most inhospitable place in the world.
Just walk across it.
Yeah. So their plan was to send two ships, one the Endurance from South Georgia, which is a little island in the South Atlantic, to one side of Antarctica. Send another ship, the Aurora, to the other side of Antarctica. And that will have a party that hikes fairly far in and lays depots. And Shackleton, from his side, will walk across. And hopefully, once they get beyond halfway, there'll be these depots that have been set up by the Aurora for them to get across.
How did they know they'd be able to find the depots?
They're just very, very good navigators. Yeah, well, yeah, one, they're very, very good at that sort of thing.
Right.
And two, yeah, it's trusting massively.
Because, I mean, if it's 100 metres that way and buried in snow.
Right, yeah.
You just walk straight past it.
Yeah. And what if the Aurora party had real bad troubles?
Yeah.
And weren't able to put these depots out for whatever reason.
Unseasonable snowstorms.
Yeah. Then you're screwed again. So
okay, well, you could luck to them, you know.
Yeah. So this story is just sort of an incredible one of will, the will to survive. Because there's a book written about it by Shackleton. You can buy it just in Penguin. It's just called South. And it's an incredible read, I think. There's also the audiobook of it for free on YouTube, a LibriVox recording. It's in the public domain.
yeah, I've listened to a lot of those as well,
It's like about 15 hours long.
Yeah.
So it's, but I want to quote a fair bit from it, if that's all right.
Yeah, that's fine.
All right, so what happens is they set out just before World War One starts, literally like a week or two after World War One starts in summer 1914. Mm. So that's when it starts. And in fact, Shackleton says to the Admiralty, he says, look, if you need, because loads of his crew are Royal Navy or ex-Royal Navy people, and the ships are sort of Admiralty ships. If you need us, of course we'll abandon this expedition. And they're like, no, no, it's fine. We've got the North Atlantic Battle Fleet. Thanks.
Right.
We've got battleships. We don't need your 300-ton wooden explorer ship.
Yeah.
So we'd rather you go off and do this thing.
Yeah.
So he gets the green light from the Admiralty to do that. So they go down to the Endurance. I won't talk much about the Aurora. Maybe at the end just say what happened to them. But although they went on lots of adventures, it's just not the most interesting one of the two ships by far. Okay. And in the book South, Shackleton does tell you everything that happened to the Aurora as well.
Right, okay.
But so anyway, they go down to South Georgia and they end up pushing off from South Georgia for the Antarctic in December. October.
Sorry, where's South Georgia?
It's in the South Atlantic.
Right.
It's a bit more south than the Falklands, if you know where the Falklands are.
Oh, right, right.
It's down there.
Yeah.
It's down there. Yeah. And just to mention South Georgia, because it comes back into the stories, it's not a small island. It's not massive by any means, but it's not that small. It's got mountains on it.
Right.
And it's got a couple of whaling stations on it. And back then, no one had ever been, even though whalers and people like Drake had known it was there hundreds of years earlier. No one had ever gone more than 1 mile inland on South Georgia.
Hmm.
It's like, again, there's like glaciers on it, mountains and glaciers, and there's no point really. There's no real need to hike into the interior of South Georgia.
There's nothing there.
But there are a couple of whaling stations there.
Yeah.
One is a Stromness whaling station. Right. So in other words, there's like civilization. There's an outpost of human civilization. Yeah. On South Georgia.
But I mean, I'm guessing there's just nothing on this island.
Right? No.
Because it's so far south, it's basically frozen.
Yeah. There's glaciers and that's it. So yeah, it's extremely remote, is South Georgia. So they set off from South Georgia in October 1914. And of course, back in those days, there was that's it. Until they come back, no one would know what happened to them. Mm. So they sort of head off into the wilderness, so to speak. And they're not heard from again for a bit, for a while.
And we're talking, years, right?
In the end, yeah.
Because, I mean, everything in the pre-modern era took a long time to do.
Yeah.
And this is something that people forget. It's like, yeah, I'm going away. I'll be years. Then I'll come back and hopefully my wife will still be alive.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Shackleton and loads of the other men have got families back home. And, their families just have to wait.
Yeah, and hope you come back.
And just hope you come back, Hope that one day you don't get news that they're lost or dead or something. That's all you can do. In fact, at one point, just to mention super quick, at one point on the Endurance, they did have some sort of radio antenna, super, super early radio-type antenna thing.
Hmm.
And it never, ever works. A few times they put it out and try and listen in for any messages coming from places like the Falklands or South Georgia, and they never hear anything. But they haven't got a transmitter, so they could never send messages back anyway, because the technology is still really, really new back then. Even though obviously steel ships, metal ships exist, you actually want a wooden ship back then for pushing through ice.
Really? Why?
Because the metal ships, even though it's metal, it's very thin metal.
Right.
And ice will just crush it in, right. Stove it in, like straight away. You can barely, apparently, you can barely touch the ice pack with a metal ship back then.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, modern ship ice cutters are different, yeah. But back then, whereas a wooden one, it's quite hard to compact woods, especially particular types of wood that are very, very hard. The Endurance was built by one of the greatest, actually, Norwegian shipbuilders, and they use special treated wood that they know, like, the front of the ship is going to be trying to push into ice.
Right.
It's like you can use wooden, wooden things to prop up whole buildings.
Mm.
Certain types of wood can take tons and tons and tons and tons of pressure.
Tremendous compressive force.
Yeah, right. Resist, yeah. So they head down there. And so they're on the side that's on the Weddell Sea. The other ship, the Aurora, goes to the same sorts of places as Scott went to.
Mm.
Shackleton's like on the whole other side of Antarctica, the Weddell Sea. One thing just to mention very, very quickly, that Shackleton needed a bit of sort of private finance to get it done. The Admiralty weren't prepared to pay for absolutely everything.
Right.
Because the grand prize of the pole had already been gone.
Mm.
So he has to get, there's a bit at the beginning of South where he talks all about trying to get private wealth to help him out. And one of the private individuals that's prepared to give him money is called James Caird. And anyway, his name will come up again. I'll mention that as it comes up. So they don't take ponies this time.
Good
They've
thinking.
Realized they take loads of dogs, loads, like 60 dogs, 61 dogs to begin with. Loads of dog teams. They learnt from Amundsen. They learnt from Scott and Amundsen of that example. It was like, okay, it's dogs. Yeah. That's what you want to do. But unfortunately, what happens to the Endurance is very, very quickly, essentially straight away, really. They head down a few hundred miles from South Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
In the order of 800 miles, they get stuck in the pack ice. Even though it's summer, even though it's Antarctic summer, they still get stuck in the pack ice. Now, that's not unheard of.
Mm.
It happened to the Nimrod and the Discovery and the Terra Nova.
Yeah.
But they always got out of it. You wait long enough, you get out of it. Well, they get stuck in it over the whole summer and the autumn and the following winter. They spend a whole winter just stuck in.
So they're basically in the ice for almost a year.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Must have been insufferable.
It's sort of mad. Well, we look back at it now. Historians or whatever scholars can look back at it now, and they see that in fact the previous expeditions, in a sense, got lucky. It didn't happen to them.
Right.
It's not that the Endurance is a freak thing.
Right. Right.
It's that it was freakish that ones before it hadn't happened to.
Yeah.
It's very, very, very easy for that to happen to.
Right.
So to begin with, it's almost straight away. In fact, I want to quote a fair bit from South in this one. And we're told, like, within the first few pages, quote, "The Endurance maintained against the flow for the next 24 hours when the gale moderated." There's loads of gales, again, unseasonable gales.
Mm.
"The pack extended to the horizon in all directions and was broken by innumerable narrow lanes. Many bergs were in sight, and they appeared to be travelling through the pack in a southwesterly direction under the current influence. Probably the pack itself was moving northeast with the gale." So even though they're packed into the pack ice, it's still moving along.
Yeah, yeah.
Just with the currents of the ocean.
Yeah.
So you're still, wherever it wants to take you, that's the thing.
Yeah, you're just going with it. Yeah.
Wherever it's going, you're going.
Yeah.
And at different points, you can tell that you still sort of bob up and down a bit. And then other times you're sort of stuck completely fast and you're not moving at all. They see lots of incredible things, really. They see lots of incredible, where I mentioned Scott can't help but try and describe some of the beautiful scenery he sees.
Yeah, yeah.
Shackleton's the same. They see lots of wildlife, where Scott doesn't really mention wildlife all that much.
Mm.
Shackleton does, because also just to mention that Scott's journals were exactly that. They were just journals that were found on his body. Whereas South is really it's more a piece of literature. It's all true. It's not fictional. It's not true. But it's more a piece of literature that was written after with a bit of forethought and been edited by people.
Yeah, so and time to breathe on it.
And, right.
Yeah.
Whereas Scottish journals are literally like journal entries, like a diary. Whereas,
yeah, I'm literally dying in the Antarctic.
Yeah. Yeah. But we get, we've told lots of sort of wonderful things. He talks loads about petrels, all different types of birds. I seem to have been a bit of an ornithologist. Lots of penguins, all different types of seals. Crab eaters, he mentions, all different types of seals, leopard seals, all types of stuff. Loads of different types of whales, even blue whales, he sees, and lots of orcas, loads of orcas. Some of the dogs, actually, because the dogs are sweet, really. I mean, I love dogs, but where there's so many of them to begin with, they give them all names. Again, like Scott, they treat them like pets, really. Yeah. And lots of their names are just normal names, just like Luke or Bob.
Well, you've got 60 to name.
But loads of them, they give weird names, like Split Lip, Sidelights, Satan, Bummer, Smuts, Slippery, all different names like this. but again, they're quite vicious. At one point in the Arura party, one dog gets killed because the others set upon it and they can't break them up quick enough and they kill one of them.
Blimey.
But yeah, so that's something to say. I've got another quick line here where it mentions sort of some of the things they see. Shackleton wrote, quote, "At the junction of several flows," this is when they're already packed in, "at the junction of several flows, chaotic areas of piled up blocks and masses of ice are formed, sometimes 5 to 6 feet, 5 to 6 feet piles of evenly shaped blocks of ice are seen so neatly laid that it seems impossible for nature, for them to have been nature's work." So there's loads of times when he mentions that there's what you see is just something sort of you couldn't quite believe. It's like a bizarre sight. How is that? How's that happened? Yeah. You just wouldn't think that that's the case of things to happen. I mean, they eat quite well because whilst they're on the ship, they've got loads of stores.
Yeah.
Because they were meant to land on Antarctica and put out all these lots and lots of depots. It's meant to be an expedition that's going to last a couple of years. So their ship, the Endurance, is absolutely packed full of provisions and all sorts of things. On Christmas, he says they have turtle soup, whitebait, jugged hare, Christmas pudding, mince pies, dates, figs, and crystallised fruits.
Well, sounds like they're eating very well.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the advantage of going to the Antarctic is at least your food's not going to spoil, right? It's cold all the time, surely.
Yeah.
So, you know, natural refrigeration.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, like, you've always got, like you say, seals and things like that you could shoot and eat, right? Mm. So there is food around. Mm. It's just not going to be very delicious.
Yeah.
So I've never eaten seal. Maybe it is nice.
Yep. Seal steaks and penguin steaks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Doesn't sound terrible.
Yeah. Well, they do end up eating lots of that. So they go about 700 miles before they're... There's quite a few pages of them going through the pack, and sometimes to begin with, before they get stuck, they get stuck a bit, and then they get out. And Shackleton's sort of skirting the pack and trying to find a lane. They talk about lanes getting through, and the ship can even push in a bit and kind of crack it open and push itself through.
Well, this is something that I learned when I was quite young. So we went to it was some warship that was docked somewhere in England, and you can push on it and you, as just the person, can just push the ship away from the dock because it turns out that nothing's fixed. Mm-hmm. So it just slowly you can push a giant, 1,000-ton ship away from the dock.
Mm.
It's crazy. Mm. And so I'm not surprised that, like, with the ship you can push it out because there's actually nothing stopping it. It's just about getting it to move.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that first initial thing. Yeah. Like when you see World's Strongest Man pulling a whole lorry or a whole 747. But it's like getting it started. That's what requires incredible strength.
But there's
once it's rolling, that's something
different. There's actual resistance there, right?
Right.
Whereas like with a giant ship on the water, well, the water doesn't hold it in place, So you can push it. It's just very, very slow.
Yeah. So even that with like million tons of icebergs.
Yeah, yeah.
You can just, if you get it, if you can get it moving. Because the Endurance is a sail ship, but also it's got an engine.
Right.
Also, but they have only got a few tons, well, I think 100 tons or something like that. They've got a few tons of coal.
Yeah.
So they can't just keep the engine running all the time.
Yeah.
It's for special needs.
Yeah.
And when they want to try and, he describes all about how they'll try and find a particular V-shape, natural V-shape cut into the side of the pack.
Mm.
And if you sort of wedge the ship in there and then push
it
forward,
apart, yeah.
You can sort of make a lane. Or if there's a tiny crack or a lane, you can make it wider.
Yeah.
And he says, as long as the ice isn't more than 3 foot thick, you can push through it.
Right.
Which is interesting. Yeah. Mm. Lots of descriptions of that sort of thing. Loads of descriptions of the icebergs. I suppose that's the main thing to see. But they're fascinating. I'll put up a picture of some icebergs where they're so sort of unbelievably blue. It sounds weird to say, but they're just so blue. They're icebergs that have come, true icebergs that have come off of glaciers. You sort of can't believe the colours of blue that are in them. Mm. But they, where sometimes you get stuck in the flows, as he says, you get stuck near particular icebergs that are stuck with you and you become acquainted with them, familiar with them.
Yeah.
I mean, you see them every single day for maybe weeks or months or years on end.
Yeah.
Shackleton wrote, one mighty specimen was shaped like the Rock of Gibraltar, but with steeper cliffs, because they also could be massive.
Yeah.
An iceberg could be 5 miles long, could be 1,000 feet high out of the water or more. Sometimes they're absolutely gigantic, but with steeper cliffs than the Rock of Gibraltar. And another had a natural dock that could have contained the Aquitania, just a big ship. A spur of ice closed the entrance to this huge blue pool. So yeah, it's just interesting that all the different things they see. I think if anyone is interested in this, do read the book or listen to the audio book, because I'm only going to scratch the surface here.
Yeah.
If we do an hour, or hour and a half, even 2 hours, it's just going to scratch the surface. Mm. I think it's a great book. I've read it through a few times and listened to the audio book a couple of times. It's one of those things I keep coming back to, like a bridge too far. I can't sort of, every few years I come back to it again.
Yeah.
I don't know why particularly, but I just think it's great. Okay. So they see eventually when they get when they finally get just completely locked into the ice, they don't know, of course, that they're going to be locked into it for the whole winter.
They just
so they don't start panicking or anything like that. They just treat it like a normal thing, a relatively normal thing. And they go out on the ice. They go do a bit of skiing, play a bit of football or hockey, he says. They do realise at one point that they're going to be locked into it for a while, though. You can just tell by the weather and by the ice that you're not going to get out in the next day or two, regardless of anything. So they sort of let the dogs out of the ship, because the dogs are sort of packed into kennels on the ship. So they make sort of what they call dog loos, like an igloo, but for dogs. And they let them out on the ice, and the dogs prefer that. The dogs love it.
I bet the dogs are thrilled, yeah.
Yeah. But they start losing dogs fairly quickly to worms.
Right.
It just says they get worms and they're so ill. Some of the dogs are so ill with worms that they have to shoot them.
God.
Yeah. Because again, being World War One era.
Yeah.
They haven't got like brilliant.
Antibiotics.
And... Yeah, they haven't got brilliant. Well, there's no antibiotics, right, yeah. But they haven't even, they've got a vet, but he can't do much really for them.
The things I'd need are about 10,000 miles away.
yeah.
What am I supposed to do?
And they see lots of penguins, all different types of penguins, but actually emperor penguins, which are the biggest type of penguin. Mm. And Shackleton says they're, quote, curiously human.
Yeah.
Just in their mannerisms and the way they waddle along. And just, he just says this. Yeah, I think that's funny. They're curiously human. At one point, actually, just to mention, before they get stuck for the last time in the pack ice, they do actually see the land. They could have landed on the land at one point. They're like about 100 miles from the land,
right?
And they see the land. But Shackleton's thinking is, we want to sail as far south as we possibly can,
right?
Because every mile that you sail is a mile you don't have to manhaul stuff. And so he kicks himself. He rues the day he passed up a chance to hit land.
Yeah, he does.
Because a couple of times they could have hit land.
Yeah.
And he decides not to because on that day the pack isn't too bad.
Just optimism.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. When to begin with, when they get stuck for the last time, he keeps the boiler going in the engine room, 24/7 for about 10 days, hoping that if at any moment a lane opens up, they can just immediately make the most of it. But after about 10 days, that he realizes this just
it's not happening.
He may as well save the coal.
Mm.
Says they do. Club a few penguins and a few seals. Because even though their ship, the Endurance, is still full of provisions, they want to try and save them if they possibly can.
But you don't know how long you're going to be there.
Yeah,
desperate things might get. You know?
And we may as well, I mean, they've still got nice, good food, but we may as well feed the dogs seal steaks and blubber and liver. Liver is really, really good for men and dogs.
Mm.
The iron in liver. Apparently when you're stuck on the ice like that, because it's still Antarctic summer, so the sun's still up, apparently you just get loads and loads of different light effects and mirages and things.
Oh, the same sort of thing that Scott found.
Right? Yeah. Shackleton wrote, quote, "From the masthead, the mirage is continually giving us false alarms. Everything wears an aspect of unreality.
Mm.
Icebergs hung upside down in the sky. The land appears as layers of silvery or golden cloud. Cloud banks look like land. Icebergs masquerade as islands. And the distant barrier to the south is thrown into view, although it really is outside our range of vision. Worst of all is the deceptive appearance of open water, caused by the refraction of distant water, or by the sun shining at an angle on a field of smooth snow, or the face of ice cliffs below the horizon." They're just all sorts of different weird things. Sometimes they talk about the sun has got like a halo or a double or a triple halo around
it. Yeah, it's like sun dogs and things like that. They're called strange, weird effects where particles of water in the atmosphere or ice in the atmosphere refract the light. So you just perceive the world as being strange. But I like the description, an aspect of unreality. That's good.
Says that a few times. Says that, I think, that exact word a few times.
Yeah.
That it's, you just sort of wouldn't, unless you've seen it with your own eyes, you wouldn't think that this would be the case.
No. I actually find it very believable because when you're a temperate creature from temperate realms and you're, designed for normal places, you get somewhere of these sort of extremes, and it's the same in the desert where you get like mirages and the heat coming off the desert, refracting light in weird ways. Like, you're not used to this. You don't know what you're looking at. And I can see how it would be disorienting, and make you feel like there's something weird and kind of magical about the place.
Yeah. And again, like Scott's saying, that sometimes when the sky, because the sky can be all different colours, can't it? It can be blue, obviously, but it can be grey and overcast. But sometimes the sky's just white, isn't it?
Well, if it's like full of like mist and ice particles and things like this.
And if there's any sort of blizzard or anything like that, the sky is essentially white.
Mm.
And then
the ground is also white, then you might feel the world is sort of turning upside down and...
Exactly. Yeah. It's otherworldly, bizarre, and unreality.
Mm.
There's no, you can't see the horizon. It's just all white.
Mm.
As far as you can see, 360, every direction you
look. Like you've gone into the Bermuda Triangle or something,
Yeah. At various points, they try and sort of dig themselves out. Mm. There's lots of pictures.
I was going to ask about that. Could they at any point, I suppose they couldn't if they were stuck for a year.
Yeah, I know. They do take loads and loads of photographs. Mm. One of their photographer guy, Frank Hurley, must mention him, mentioned in dispatches. He was a great photographer. Again, it's very early stuff on glass slides.
Yeah.
And there's a real art to getting a decent exposure, but he was a master at it. Some say he's one of the best of all time at that sort of thing. Right, Frankly, so we've got a fair few photos that survive, and I'll put some up so people can see, even if them trying to dig it out. There's no way you could truly dig it out, but what you could do is at least try and relieve some of the pressure.
Yeah, loosen.
And they can do it a bit, But what will happen is you could spend a couple of days of all the hands expending endless energy.
And then 10 minutes,
yeah,
the ice moves and you're trapped again. Right.
The pack just goes, yeah, no, and just crushes up against it again in minutes flat. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the idea of cutting a channel in front of the ship to just keep going forward, it's not going to, the amount of energy and time it takes is just not going to happen.
Yeah. Tim, they didn't have some dynamite or something.
Yeah, I don't, yeah, they don't. No, I don't think they have anything like that.
Yeah.
Again, they just honestly didn't expect this to happen.
Yeah, because they've been lucky the other times.
Yeah.
So
they say, yeah, the pack might get you, but eventually...
It's not that bad.
Yeah, eventually it lets you out.
Yeah.
Well, not always. They do mention orcas, because orcas or gladiator orcas, they mention.
Yeah.
Shackleton wrote, "These aggressive creatures were to be seen often in the lanes and pools, and we were always distrustful of their ability or willingness to discriminate between seal and man. A lizard-like head would show while the killer gazed along the flow with wicked eyes. Then the brute would dive to come up a few moments later, perhaps, under some unfortunate seal reposing on the ice." So they watch them. And there's other bits where he says, you see them working together.
Mm.
And they're, yeah, again, they've got...
clever and sinister.
They've got the eyes of a mammal.
Mm.
So they're a thinking thing.
Oh, yeah.
It's not like the dead doll's eye of a shark.
Oh, yeah.
It's
it's
looking to see what to do and they're making new plans and stuff.
Because a shark is...
really.
Sharks are terrifying, but they are at the very least essentially just a monster.
Yeah, they're dumb. They're dumb. They're, they've got the mind of a fish.
Yeah, exactly. A shark, but an orca, as you say, it's a mammal. It's smart. And they are smart. You know, that's the thing. They're genuinely smart.
Yeah.
So if it's thinking, oh, look at this weird thing that I could eat.
Yeah,
they're giant and they've got serrated teeth, flesh.
And he says they're like never not hungry.
Mm.
All orcas at all time will eat anything they can get at all times.
Well, they weigh like 2 or 3 tons.
Yeah,
of course they're always hungry.
Yeah, they're,
look at
they're massive. Yeah, they are massive as well.
Yeah, they're colossal.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to tangle with one.
No, God no.
Mirages were frequent, we're told. Barrier cliffs appear all around us. Even in places where they knew it was deep water, they couldn't possibly be. It's just a mirage.
Mm.
Bergs and packs are thrown up in the sky and distorted into the most fantastic shapes. They climb trembling upwards, spreading out into long lines of different levels. Yeah.
Right. So it's very interesting how, like, everything... like, from the position of the person, it feels like everything's working against you, right? Like, the landscape itself takes on a kind of sinister aspect, as if it's trying to prevent you from coming to this place.
Mm.
And then you've got the orcas, which is the constant, you know, terror in the sea.
Mm.
That, you know, you can't go out onto the ice without thinking, is an orca going to, like, smash this ice and eat me? You know, drag me down like it does with the seals?
It's a worry at all times, and it comes back later when they're in more perilous straits than this.
Right.
That, at any moment, an orca could just burst up from directly beneath you.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
You're in trouble.
What a terrifying thing, especially if you're camping out on the pack ice and you're asleep. You're just in a sleeping bag on the ice, which may be way less than a foot thick or 3 foot thick.
Yeah.
An orca can easily punch through that in one go.
Yeah.
Yeah, how terrifying would that be?
Yeah, that's awful. And so the entire thing takes on this kind of, like, you've gone in some sort of elf land or something, fairy land, where it's like, you know, your senses are under attack, but like you've taken LSD and there are these dangerous animals everywhere. And so there's weird colors and optical illusions and, you know, and the thing is you're trapped there as well. You can't go anywhere.
Yeah.
So it's got a very interesting, like, mythical sort of side to this.
There's really no way out. You are in the most remote places, among the most remote places you can go on the earth.
Yeah.
You know, the Atlantic Ocean. It's sort of brave beyond measure. I mean, it's foolhardy, really.
Mm.
It's like there's a fine line between bravery and stupidity, right?
Yeah.
They often say you just ignore it.
Yeah.
I suppose it's like people that do, I mentioned Alex Honnold, didn't I? The free climber, solo free climber. I suppose, or some of them say, you just don't think about it.
Well, that's lucky then.
You just don't.
I'd be thinking about it all the time.
How could you? I wouldn't be able to not have it in the forefront of my mind.
Persistently terrified by the environment.
He says explicitly, we seem to be drifting helplessly in a strange world of unreality. So he says it again.
Yeah.
It's interesting you say, like, taking LSD or something. It's just, yeah, you're in a bizarre world suddenly. Yeah.
It feels like you've crossed over to another dimension where the laws of physics don't really apply. And now you're in it. You're not the top animal on the land, right? Because normally, you know, whenever anything sees a human, oh God, it's a human, quick run as quickly as we can in the other direction, panicking. Like, it's incredible. Whenever I'm riding my bike home or something, and I see a deer, the deer just freaks out and runs. I'm like, dude, I'm not going to hurt you, you know, but it doesn't know, you know? And so that's the sort of experience that humans generally have with nature. It's like, actually everything retreats from us. But this is the total inversion of that. It's like, nature just does not care about you at all. The environment is not here for you. It doesn't care if you live or die. In fact, it's actively trying to kill you. It's distorting the things you see, and your perceptions, your senses are all fallible. And there are these giant black monsters in the sea that are trying to eat you.
It's funny you should say that, how animals always flee from humans.
Yeah.
Well, here, yeah, penguins.
Yeah, they probably don't.
They don't at all.
They don't know what you are.
They just look at you as you walk up to them. You're going to kill them. And they just, like, watch you. They've got no idea. They're completely, their mind's blown. They've never seen anything, any humans or any civilization or any, probably any ships.
They don't know what a human being is. For millions of years, these penguins have been at the Antarctic and humans haven't.
Sometimes they say they'll just walk up to penguins and, like, and they're just, like, completely nonplussed. Don't do anything. Don't try and flee or anything. They're just puzzled, interested.
Yeah.
And they club the first one, and then obviously the penguins realise they're in danger and they start squawking and try and get away, but they can't really, because they just waddle along. Yeah, they can't. But yeah, until there's a little anecdote they talk when there's some penguins that are on much later in the story. Yeah. Is on another little bit of pack of ice that's when they get into a situation where the pack has broken up again. And it's just out of reach of them and, like, literally a few feet out of reach, and they can't get it. And it still is just looking at them, it's just staring at them, and they will kill it in a moment if they could.
Yeah.
And it doesn't understand it's in any danger. And it's just looking at them, and they think it's funny, and it is kind of funny.
It does go show
how naive it is. Or whatever.
It does go show you that the animal responses to humans are definitely learned behaviors, right? It's definitely learned over, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. Oh, no, there's a human. Quick run.
Yeah.
That's bad, you know?
Yeah.
So it wasn't, you know, it's not that it's some intrinsic thing that has always been there or something like that, you know, like there's something about the form or something or whatever. No. This is animals everywhere have learned that humans are bad news. That's good.
Seals as well, often they'll just watch as you walk up to them. They don't try and get away, or they don't seem scared or anything.
Yeah.
So it's like taking candy from a baby, really.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No